When that happens, it doesn't mean that you can then be predict that something is particular is going to happen. It means that something like, just something like a natural disaster like that, which was not just a natural disaster, as we all know in this room, and as many, many know, when something like that happens, it has all kinds of connections with all kinds of things that you don't even think of as having connections with. Political connections, social connections, geographic connections, and so on and so on and so on. That particular thing has the probability of having an enormous political impact because of the way it's going to connect with everything else that's been going on. But I want to warn you that the shift that is very likely to take place is more likely to go to the right than to the left, even though a good many people in this country now are much who are decent people and reasonably conscious people, socially conscious people, even though a good many people are going to become even angrier or more outraged than they have been about the poor and the people who are discriminated against racially, that doesn't mean much except insofar as what we do about it. Because the people who are not decent, and I will use that word carefully, the people who are not decent, that is to say, the people who are in some sense consciously and happily racist, and happily hate the poor, happily, voluntarily hate the poor, even though they may have been conditioned to do that, nevertheless, they've got the habit of hating the poor and hating the people who are not, quote, white, which is such a ridiculous notion in the first place. Those people are not only going to look at this disaster as a good thing in terms of being having to be paid for mostly by the poor and the black. It's a good thing, they will think. The people who are racist will like that. But they will also be galvanized by, and then they say prodded on by the kinds of reactions that people like us have. I mean, one of the things, as I was saying to Michael before this evening began, is that although in the past 30 years or so, the past, let's say, make it generous, the past 40 years or so, although there has been a distinct change in the attitudes of people toward racism and poverty, that is positive. And there have been institutional changes in both respects that have been positive. Quite apart from the fact that neither of them went as far as they needed to go and should go, must go, it is also true that there was more satisfaction than there should have been on the part of people who were happy to see that happen, who had always wanted that or became educated to see it as necessary and desirable. And one of the consequences of that whole movement, of, let's call it the civil rights anti-poverty movement, one of the sets of consequences of that in the last 40 years as time has gone on is that there's a whole generation or two of young people who are by no means as racist inwardly as their parents were. I'm thinking about whites now, okay, white kids. Now, part of what we can say is because of their fix on the culture, the pop culture that has so much of black entertainers in it. But that's not it at all. That's part of it. That's only part of it. What's happened is that there's been a whole sea change, so to speak, which has affected the younger generation, people who are under 40, let's say now, in ways that are much more solid than the older generation because, of course, they were young, more malleable. But at the same time, racism, even though racism has lessened, so to speak, quantitatively, in terms of that generational sort of thing, I don't think it has changed qualitatively, except for the worse. I mean, the people who are supporting Bush now, and the likes of Bush, are many of them people who were unconsciously racist 50 years ago, who are consciously racist now, and damned enthusiastic about doing things that are supporting people who are going to do things that are racist in their nature and racist in their targets. Not to say something else, which is the people who are like that are also going to find somebody like Bush and his administration attractive in other ways, whether it has to do with the war in Iraq or being anti-union or anti-Social Security, or the whole thing that the Bush administration stands for. So what I'm trying to say is that before I begin to talk about politics for us, you have to understand what's going on right this minute, which looks encouraging and indeed can be encouraging, but it can also be scary. I want to remind you that in the United States, and that's where we are, that in the United States there was never anything like fascism until the Depression of the 1930s. And then you had fascist movements springing up all over the country, literally north, south, east, west, had never existed before. At the same time that you had left movements, union movements, very strong working class movements, at the same time you had the New Deal, which was not just working class, just not just for working class people. It was a social set of social policy. That is to say, as something left of center came into being in ways that had never been before in the United States, it's also true that the right of center came into being in ways that had never been before. California, we had a fascist group. In Detroit, you had a fascist group. In Louisiana, you had a fascist group. They weren't called fascist, but that's what they were. My own father, my own dear daddy, who, thank goodness, left my mother when I was 6 years old, was one of the founders of the Committee for Constitutional Government in New York State, which was described by Governor Dewey as a fascist organization. And if Governor Dewey said it was a fascist organization, it must have been a dragon just walking on feet. You know, all over the country, there were fascist organizations growing up. None of them ever got anywhere, okay? They never got anywhere because we were the United States. And we are just as naive, we were just as naive then as we are now, with respect to, let's call it, political ideas. We've been a naive country from our very beginning. We still are. But the people on the right are not. We have to understand how well organized they are, how powerful they are. For the past 20 or 30 years, increasingly, with more and more money, they have done more and more, consciously, more and more kinds of things in order to create an active right, to finance it, to give it institutes, whether it's the American Enterprise Institute or the, you know, all kinds of research groups and so on, which we have created all kinds of people who can go out and do the work, whether it's the work of knocking on doors or the work of writing books or the work of this or that or the other thing, or the work of lobbying. And they are working very hard and very well to make the United States into an American-style fascist society. They don't think that. It doesn't matter what they think, but that's what they're doing. They think what they're trying to do is, who knows what the hell they think they're trying to do. Some of them believe with passion in the free market, by which they mean a market run by big business. That's what they mean by it. And they don't even know what they're talking about. They don't even know what they mean by free market. Nor do the economists who support them. Some of them are hot for evangelical Christianity. Some of them are hot for against unionism. There's a combination, a bizarre combination of groups of ordinary people dominated by very powerful people, lots of money. So as this thing in Louisiana, Mississippi goes on, we should take notice of that and try to work with that. What caused that? What really allowed that to happen? Who was really hurt by it and left to be hurt by it? As we look at that as something we can use as well as sympathize with for political purposes, you want to remember that the right is thinking it at the same time exactly how can they use it and how can they benefit from it. And they've got the weapons that we don't have. I might say, incidentally, that one of the almost symbols of what's happening in Louisiana, which these two things some of you must have seen, two photographs, one of white people in the water, one of black people in the water. And the white people, it says here, two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store. There's two white people. There's a black person going through water. A young man walks through chest-deep flood water after looting a grocery store. So there's no reason whatsoever to make those two distinctions, except the way we are. They were both put out in the Associated Press. So that's where we are. And I just want to say that, get back to where I started this evening. You can't predict. You never know what's going to happen. And you never know what has happened is going to lead to. You just don't know. We just have no idea at all. All you can say is that from our point of view, because of the way things have been, the way things are, and the way things are becoming at home and abroad with the United States, we're in a crisis which is very, very deep already. And it is a situation where we have to educate ourselves so that we can also educate others who are decent people but not well-informed, not sufficiently well-informed, so that we can get people to get off our asses and recognize that we're not doing something because it's fun to do it. We're doing it because it's a matter of literally life and death. It's a matter in the short term of decent life or indecent life, but in the long term, by which I mean 20 years, it's life or death. I give us 20 years the way things are going. Because a war is going to break out, and we're going to use those nukes just as sure as hell. And when we start to use them, that's it. Quite apart from the environmental disaster that we're contributing to disproportionately. So let's get serious. On our website is the epilogue to the book, the recent book I wrote but will not be published. I'm quite sure it's not going to be published, and I don't care much about that anymore. The epilogue has as its subtitle, "We Must Disenthrall Ourselves." We must disenthrall ourselves. Some of you will know that that's something that Abraham Lincoln said during the Civil War. We must disenthrall ourselves. In the epilogue, I go on to say that he needed to disenthrall himself, too, because he had a really shitty attitude about slavery. Okay, he was not against slavery. The war, the Civil War, kids, was not about slaves. It was about power. It was about who was going to rule the United States. How were the resources of the United States going to be used? By whom? For what? There is also, of course, on the website, the first chapter of that book, which is called The United States Becomes Its Own Worst Enemy, which I say, talk about that sort of thing, and so on and so on. Almost everyone, I don't want to qualify it, everyone has to disenthrall himself or herself, because we are all enthralled by the society in which we grow up and become not just children but adults. No one grows up anywhere except in a society, whether even in the primitive world. They were all affected, all infected by whatever was thought to be right and wrong, decent and indecent, good or bad, interesting or dull, by the society in which you live. We are all, our hearts and minds are shaped by the society in which we live. Period. There's no question about that. I don't care what anyone says. There's no question about that. We are the society in which we live, in different degrees, because society is always a very complicated set of relationships, whether your people are poor or rich, whether their religion and so on. But we are all in the same society, and the society is ruled over in a certain way, changing over time, but the time is not, the time span for most of us is not long enough for us to break loose, so to speak, from our socialization, unless there's a revolution. And even then, one of the reasons revolutions don't work very well is because they're working in a society which everybody's been socialized to believe that this is right and that's wrong. And one of the things that's wrong is what the revolution has tried to bring about, whether in China or Russia or wherever. There's nobody in this room, there's nobody in this on this earth who hasn't been brainwashed, to give it a negative term, who has not been socialized to take certain things for granted, which people in another society don't take for granted at all. Understand? Which people in the same society didn't take for granted a century ago, when it wasn't, of course, the same society. It was the same nation, but it wasn't the same, because nothing is ever the same as time passes. Now, when I say we must disenthrall ourselves, I mean I, too, we all must disenthrall ourselves. We have a term, I was discussing this in an earlier meeting, we talk about ideology. Well, ideology is another way of talking about what our thrall is. The thraldom within which we live is our ideology. What we take to be right and wrong, what captures our hearts and our minds, what we find, even the things we can find interesting or dull. We are pliable creatures, you understand? We're animals, but we have the defect of our virtue. Our virtue is we're much smarter, we say, than other animals, but that's a wrong term. We're much more imaginative than other animals. That's the kind of brain structure that we have. Enables us to think things that aren't true, for better and for worse. To think music, for example. Music doesn't exist except insofar as it's created by human beings and by birds. And that's not music, any more than a fart is music. It's what birds do, and they're probably trying to do something which is not to entertain each other. Because we can imagine, we're able to fear, and we're able to hope, we're able to create, and we're able to destroy in a way that no other species can do. But the kinds of things we imagine, where the imagination is intellectual and cultural, physical even, when a man thinks about a woman with some kind of excitement, imagination is at work, so that's imagination too. Whatever it is that we think within a framework of the society in which we live. And that framework is a framework which has been created by and is dominated by the people who rule that society, who came to rule that society. Marx was very good about this, and I quote him in talking about ideology. The ideas of any era, he says, are the ideas of its ruling class. The ideas, mind you. And the class that controls the means of life, he says, is the class that also controls our thought. Our ways of thinking, not just what we think, but our ways of thinking. Whether we think, shall we say, scientifically or unscientifically. Or what's going on right now? One of the quarrels that's going on in the press right now, that is, say, in the country, because it's going on in the press, it's also going on in the press, I should say, is evolution versus intelligent design. Well, when I was a boy, 4 years ago, When I was a boy, of course, there were people who didn't call it intelligence design. Intelligence design, incidentally, is the latest spin. It's really a very clever idea. It's a spin term. Instead of talking about creationism, they talk about intelligent design. Okay? Intelligent design is something that was never talked about before until recently, although creationism was talked about for a long time. In this country especially, and almost only, incidentally. We're a screwball country when it comes to almost any kind of ideas. We're a good country, too, when it comes to some things, but we're a screwball about almost anything that has to do with the brain. Right now, for example, if I were a boy now, let's say 6, 10 years old, going to school, 6 out of every 10 schools in the United States, if I were going to one of those 6, I would grow up in my schoolroom, taking it for granted, because the teacher says so, that there are 2 ways of thinking about why people became what they are. One is the guy whose name was the end of the D. I say, Darwin, I think. No, I'm sorry. And the other one was creation, intelligent design. Now, when I was a kid, there wasn't any such discussion going on. There were a lot of people who believed in this, that, and the other thing, but there wasn't any discussion like that going on, and certainly not in the schools unless they were in the South. In that article I'm talking about, which is on the website, the United States becomes its own worst enemy, I'm saying we're becoming like the South as a nation, okay? And that's what we're doing. The South, whatever its virtues, and I've lived in the South, worked in the South, and it has a lot of virtues. Well, whatever its virtues, it's a self-destructive society. It always has been. When I say always has been, I mean since it began to be the South, the United States. Destructive in one sense. In the first place, it was based on slavery. It was based on slavery. And that right there is self-destructive. I don't want to go into that. I happen to be a student of slavery. I don't want to go into it because it's too complicated. But it is self-destructive to live in a slavery society and accept it. Okay, everyone is destroyed, not just the slave. Anyway, what I want to say to you, to get away from all this more or less complicated discussion, is that all of us in this room, everyone outside this room, no matter who you are, whether you're right or left or center, whether you're dead in the center, we all have attitudes, beliefs, feelings, which are very, very different from what we would have had if we had been born in, say, China, France, or Italy, or Cuba. I mean, they're different no matter where you are. To some degree or another, and the degree is very great if you're talking about China, for example. I have Chinese friends who are very rational, very this, that, and the other, but there's a certain block there. I'm talking about Chinese friends now who were raised in the Chinese culture. And I might say those who are also raised in the U.S. culture, have a real trouble with the U.S. culture. It just doesn't make any sense to them at all. Just as theirs wouldn't make much sense to us. Neither is right nor wrong. They're different from each other. In some respects, they're better than each other. In others, they're worse than each other, and so on. What I'm trying to say is, we are all enthralled by this one. If you grew up here, you have certain things you take for granted. Certain things you don't want, certain things you do want, and so on. Certain things you approve of, certain things you don't like. Certain people you look at one way, and others you look at another way. We were taught that, not by some dictator, but by living in this society. And it's as though we have a lot of poison in our bodies that is eating away at our health as human beings, slowly. And we have to recognize it to get rid of it. If we are going to try to change the society, we have to change ourselves also. Now, I think everyone in this room is a decent person. I'm not talking about you have to become decent like me because you're now indecent. I'm not saying that. I'm saying everyone in this room, me too, okay? I'm not joking about that. We all have so many prejudices in us. Prejudices are things that are judgments made without thought. There's so many responses we have to certain kinds of signals as though that we were mechanical dummies of some sort that we have to get over if we're going to try to change the society for the better. And we must change it for the better because we're going to go down with it very soon all together in one big boat, which is full of holes. I'm trying to say, when you look at others, I'm an old guy, okay? And one of the things that's happened to me, and I'm in my 80s, as most of you know, one of the things that's happened to me, really oddly, I've now become conscious of it. Maybe I've said this before. I go bicycling every day. I walk every day. I teach. I do this, I do that. I see people on the street all the time. And I see somebody making an ass of himself. I think, Jesus, what an asshole he is. And then I'm struck. This has never happened to me except in the last 2 or 3 years. I do that too, I say to myself. I see somebody driving. Stupidly. You asshole. But I would do that too. You understand? I'm being conscious of the fact that what I don't like in other people, I have in myself also. Now, I haven't done that until just, maybe it's because when I go into that coffin, I want to be as clean as possible or something like that. I don't know what it is. It is not a conscious thing on my part. It's just that I'm conscious of myself now in ways I never used to be. I think it has something to do with age. In any case, by our own standards, we are all imperfect. And it's very difficult for us to change ourselves. But on the kinds of things that are important for this kind of discussion I'm trying to have here, when it becomes a discussion, for political social change, we're okay on that. But we have to clean ourselves out before we can tell other people your clothes are dirty. We have to know what we're talking about. We can't know what we're talking about unless we know ourselves also. Know thyself. And it follows, that's the night, the day, that thou canst not then do something to any man. Know thyself. It's a very important thing. Came out a few centuries ago. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Those are pretty good things. And I am no Christian, I can tell you that, except ethnically. I'm just as much of a Jew or a Muslim ethically or a Buddhist as I am a Christian. They're all the same together when it comes to ethics. So, know thyself. Be conscious of how prejudiced you are about certain kinds of things so that you can more fluently, more positively, more strongly talk to others. Not pointing your finger at them, but knowing their weaknesses are your weaknesses also. You understand? Instead of being invidious, you can be at one with other people, which we have to be, or they will want to spit on us. When I say all this, implied in this is we all have to get to work working with other people politically, or forget about it. It isn't good enough to know more than other people and sit home and read a book and think, ah, those assholes out there, they don't know, you know, and so on. That doesn't change anything. This makes you feel more superior, which means you're an asshole. That's what it means. I would say that the things that we have to cleanse ourselves of, mostly in the larger classifications, have to do with race, racism, class, and country. We are so poisoned in all those respects as a people. We're not the only people this way. I don't care at this moment about the other people in the world in terms of their defects. I'm concerned about ours because we can't change the other countries in the world except by harming them as we do. This country, and I think I've spent my whole adult life trying to talk about this and try to do something about it. This country is so afflicted by its racism and by its absence of class consciousness and by its adoration of this nation, which can do no wrong anytime, anywhere. We can do no wrong. Why not? Because we're the land of the free, God damn you, and the home of the brave. Bush would say those same things and mean it. And most Americans would agree with him. We're different from other countries. Other countries are wrong about this, wrong about that. Don't know differences between right and wrong. But we're okay because we're Americans. That is so arrogant and so wrong. Because we've had such a miserable history in terms of human needs, human possibilities, human decency. We've been racist from the moment we began as a society, before we were a nation by a couple hundred years. We depended upon being racist. We depended upon pushing aside the native peoples in this country, depended upon making slaves out of others to do the work that would make this nation possible in what it became. There would be no United States economy of the kind it became had it not been for slavery. This I say as solidly as I say 2 + 2 = 4. I'm an expert on U.S. history with respect to this matter. I say that so, without any embarrassment whatsoever. I've spent decades studying U.S. history. And if you don't want to believe me, read how he's in. When it comes to nationalism, I mean, we look at the Chinese, we look at the Japanese, we look at the Germans, we look at the French, we look at all these other terrible countries, all the kinds of terrible things they've done. They're Boy Scouts compared to us. First place, they're all located in one part of the earth, either because of the times in which they are strength or their size. The United States has been one of the most, if not the most warlike nation in the world's history, just in its few centuries of existence. As I've said to you before, and William Appleman Williams wrote a whole book about this called Empire as a Way of Life, between the late 18th century and before 1945, that's 1940, before World War II, the United States had more than 150 military engagements you have to call wars. Only about four or five were ever declared. Understand? We don't even declare war. We just do it. And most of the people in this country have no idea of that whatsoever. The people who lived at the time didn't, most of them, have much of an idea. But it was just done at night and by cloud. The wars that were going on over the whole continent of what became the United States, almost constant. Wars against the French, against the British, against the Dutch, against the Spanish, against the American Indians. There were constant wars going on. Against the Cubans, against the... Then we broke about the turn of the 19th century, going into the 1900s. We began to go overseas with our wars. But even before that, we had wars in the Mediterranean. Did you know about them? Of course not. Who ever teaches you that in school? I didn't learn anything. I never learned anything that I'm now speaking about tonight. I never learned any of it in school. Not one inch of it. Which is a hell of a slam. It's our educational system. It isn't as though it's not in the books. Of course it's in the books. When somebody like William Appleton Williams writes a book like that, where did he get his sources from? He got it from congressional documents, in case you're interested, where some researchers did it and they made it into a congressional document. I mean, it isn't as though the information isn't there. It's that our educational system is not interested in that kind of information. So we grow up as very dangerous innocents. All men are created equal. There it is, from our beginnings. Not all men and women are created equal. All men are created equal. All white men are created equal. All white men except those who aren't created equal are created equal, except the poor, except the... You know, we have all the excepts which you have to study to find out about, and you don't study them in the classroom, you study them someplace else. Now, some of you are in the grip of that kind of misinformation, too. Okay, so basta. I'm not going to say any more about it. Like hell, I'm not going to say any more about it. So that's the kind of ideology that we have to cleanse our minds, our souls, our hearts of. Now I want to go off on a different tack, which to me is very important. I've been a lefty, as I think most of you know, let's say since 1935 or 1936, right in there. And read a lot, talked a lot, listened a lot, did a lot about this, that, and the other thing. And after all those years, and I'm not saying I just came to this realization yesterday afternoon, after all those years of intellectual, mental, political and so on involvement, and reading, writing, arithmetic, all that, I finally come to the conclusion, what I really am most concerned with, when I say we have to change the society, I'm talking about the domestic situation now, what I'm really most concerned with, have always been concerned with, is one thing, inequality. That's it. That's the whole thing. Because when you talk about inequality, what are you talking about? You're not just talking about income inequality or wealth inequality. I'm talking about inequality in everything that is important. This is, of course, by no means confined to the United States. Nothing that's wrong with the world is confined to the United States. All I'm concerned with is we are in the United States. We have to change the United States. And inequality in the United States has always been functional, important, decisive in our evolution with respect to everything that is important to human beings. Inequality in income and wealth, of course. Inequality in power is what it really comes down to. But inequality in prestige, inequality in status, inequality in everything. Inequality in access to education, inequality in education. I don't care what it is. There's a whole pyramid of rights, privileges, in which people at the top have access to all of it. People at the bottom have access to little of it, or what little they have is unbearable. And inside that big argument on my part, which I want to talk about a bit tonight, inside that big argument that inequality is the center, the core of what's wrong, is that within that core of what's wrong is something else, which is we have to work for, which is we reduce inequality, and what we have to work for, I've mentioned many times in here, is to see to it. Whatever else we're trying to do, at home I'm talking about now, in the domestic sphere, whatever else we're trying to do, we have to say it is absolutely essential for every person in this society, no matter who, to have access to having their basic needs met, period. Basic needs for education, for health, nutrition, housing, and opportunity. Opportunity, okay? Because what's unequal that is also critical to life and death is unequal access to having your basic needs satisfied. And there's no reason for it. I mean, if we were back in primitive times, nobody had access to education because there wasn't any except informal education, learning how to deal with a tiger or something like that. But the kind of modern society I'm talking about that we live in, you have to have, you must have a decent education, where a decent education doesn't mean read and write and arithmetic. It means much more than that. It means an education where what happens is that you as a child and you as a young person, throughout your formal education, you will be allowed to, encouraged to, it'll be made easy for you to realize your own possibilities as a human being, to understand your society, to appreciate what life is all about, whether that has to do with classical music or whatever it is, to understand, to appreciate, to realize. That's what education should be about. And that has never been what it has been about in the United States, in my experience. And it's becoming less so every day that we have. The king of education is SAT. From second grade on, or is it the first grade now? Training students to pass examinations. I tell you, maybe I've said this before, I'm no dummy. I know that. I'm no genius either. You know that. But if I had to take an SAT, I never, ever, ever would have gotten into the university. I couldn't have done it. I know I couldn't have done it. I know I couldn't pass one even today. I mean, I could pass it in a sense, but you don't pass it, you get a low score or a high score. Because there's certain kinds of things that I don't dig. I'm very bad on anything that has to do with quantitative relationships, for example. At the same time, I understand those quantitative relationships very well when we're trying to refer about the quality of things. You understand? I'm very bad at mathematics, and so on and so on. And one of the things they're now talking about mostly is mathematics, and so on. Some people are good at strong in one thing and weak in another. Some things, people are mediocre in everything, and so on and so on and so on. But the SAT makes everybody seem, it's supposed to be the same. The SAT is a standardized test. And you're supposed to be standardized, and the education is supposed to be standardized. And that's not what education is about. Education is about learning, not about training. Of course we want training, but that's down here. Learning is up here. So the whole educational system is absolutely upside down. Quite apart from the fact that a high percentage of the people of the United States, when I say a high percentage, I mean something like a third minimum, never have access to anything like even a rotten education. What they get is pissed on in the schoolroom because they're poor, or they're not the right color, or some goddamn thing, or they're in some district of the United States which doesn't prize education, or something. I don't care what it is. My daughter is a grade school teacher. She teaches down in Watsonville. Her kids, her students, she's a second grade teacher. Her students are all migratory workers, kids. She's working in public schools. The kinds of things she has to teach bilingually because they're all from Spanish-speaking areas. She had to learn to do that by herself. Nobody tried to help her, except her daddy, very little. But there was no effort made by the school system in Watsonville to try to help teachers learn Spanish so they could help the students. I mean, there's no discussion of it at all. You understand? And here she has to teach these kids, try to teach them. She has to teach them all kinds of things, but mostly she has to teach them to try to relax to learn. You understand? Not to be petrified all the time. Well, somebody's going to hit them with a stick, and so on. And she's penalized for this. She has a little doubt in her, so she says, "Up yours, Buster." You wouldn't know it to see her because she's a very shy-looking sort of a person, but she's just as I am, a very shy-looking kind of a person. Gets it from her daddy. So that's education. Basic needs of education. Ask yourself, suppose you'd been denied an education, even the lousy one you had, how much worse off would you be? You know? It's so important. One of my favorite writers, Stephen Jay Gould, whom we discussed the other day, one of the things of his that I quote almost everything I write, which I've quoted in here. When they talk about Einstein a few years ago, Einstein's brain being so big and so this and that and the other thing, and he was an admirer of Einstein, don't get me wrong. I'm not, and I am less interested, he wrote, in the size and nature of Einstein's brain than I am in the near certainty that there are millions of people in the world working in the fields and in the factories who have the same brain quality. Millions! I'm certain of that. He's near certain. I'm certain. He had to print something. I don't have to print it. There's a kind of criminality in that, this denial. There's a kind of criminality that is only matched by one other form of criminality, and that's the denial of proper health care. Decent, any health care. And the denial of proper nutrition. And the denial of proper housing, and not least, the denial of the opportunity to make your life be what it could be as you decide over time what you want it to be, what you need it to be. In order to become a human being instead of an angry animal going around hating, sneering, blaming the wrong people for the wrong things, and so on and so on and so on. So the framework within which my politics works is that I want to get rid of inequality. And in doing so, get toward getting these basic needs met. Now, I realize two things, among others, I hope I realize. One is that you can't ever get rid of inequality. I'm not talking about reaching full equality in everything. I don't care about reaching it. I care about working for it. You understand? There's a real difference. I'm not interested in perfection. I'm interested in reducing rot and imperfection. Working for equality. Working for it. Not worried about, oh, what would happen if everybody had the same money and the same thing. That's bullshit. That's chicken shit bullshit. That's people who don't want change. People who like the status quo or who are scared shitless of having other people be a little stronger than they are. Because they themselves are so weak and don't like to admit it. Because everyone you know is weak as hell, myself included, in this society. Because we're ruled over by a powerhouse. Doesn't give a shit about human beings. Probably don't even give a shit about themselves. So, there's another question, which many of you in this room would feel uncomfortable about. When I was a young lefty, and for many decades after that, if somebody asked me, "What are you working for, Doug?" I would say, "Socialism, democratic socialism." I'd love it. I'd love it. I'd just love it. I would love it. I think I told some of you this story about my wonderful mother, who had never gone beyond grade school, was a decent, reasonably well-informed person in the sense of somebody who can be well-informed or doesn't do much reading at all, but just decent and sort of picked up decency on the way. And I used to have a program on KPFA, as some of you know, long ago, and this was in the early 50s when I had my own program before Mom O'Shea picked me up.
And one night I got home and the day after, I should say, I had lunch with my mother, and she was incidentally about this tall, very, very thin. She was just a tiny little creature. And she said, Douglas, she said, I was listening to you last, Douglas. She always called me Douglas until about 10 years before she died, and then she started calling me Doug. It's really interesting. It's funny how people are, you know. Douglas, she said, I was listening to you last night. She said, I really liked what you were talking about. She said, but do you have to call yourself a socialist? This is during the McCarthy period. And I said, yes, Ma, I always called her Ma, M-U-A. I said, yes, I do, because it's a dirty word, and I don't want it to be a dirty word. I said, I say it because I believe in it, and because I'm not going to start making believe that it's a dirty word. Well, okay, she said, but you really have to do that? You know, so I said. Well, now I would still say hooray for democratic socialism, but we're talking politics, and it has become such a dirty word now. You can't say it anymore. Or put it differently, in the United States, it probably isn't even relevant to talk about it. Because what we're working for is not socialism. We're working for decency, for good sense, good common sense, safe society, a safe, decent society. And if we work for it well enough, over many, many decades, when all of us probably would be gone, if we were to have a movement that was working for the meeting of people's basic needs. We can talk about this later on. The kinds of changes that would have to be made in the society to meet those basic needs would, over time, result in a democratic socialist society. But that doesn't mean you're going to get there by calling it that. But you might get there by talking about people meeting their basic needs because they goddamn well know something about their own lives and so on. I might say something else here, that socialism became a dirty word because of where it happened. Now, I was a strong supporter of Mao Zedong when he came into power. Some of you might know the book, my book, The Twisted Dream, that was published in the 70s, early 70s, which I had a long passage in strongly favorable about Mao Zedong. And if we were back there again, I would write it again that way. But everything just really went awry, went crazy there. I mean, millions of people really died because of all kinds of mistakes that were made. At the same time that Mao Zedong really thought he was doing something for the long run that was really necessary and good and so on, so on, so on. I don't want to get into that. At the same time, if you go back to the Soviet Union, whatever his defects, Lenin was a person to whom one should pay a good deal of attention. And Lenin was not Stalin. But Stalin came out of what Lenin had created. What Lenin had created and what the capitalist nations had caused to become impossible. But the real problem with both China and the Soviet Union was that the revolution came on like that. It was a revolution. It wasn't an evolution. Okay? When you talk about the Soviet Union, you're talking about Russia. As I say, when the revolution came out, it came out in Russia. 80% of the people in Russia were illiterate at the time of that revolution. They didn't have any idea that there was even a revolution going on, even though a good deal of it was in their name, to say nothing of China in the Maoist revolution. You're talking about people who, you know. So now, a socialist society is not just a society in which people will all be treated decently. It's a society in which people have to understand what's going on. It has to be a democratic society. But you can't have a democracy and do the kinds of things that both Mao and Stalin wanted to do. It required using force to make people do something they didn't understand, didn't want, and so on. Now, I ceased being a lover, so to speak, of the Soviet Revolution, when I became aware of what I thought was going on there. I want to say this just in case something's going through your mind that it doesn't belong there, as far as I'm concerned. I never, ever publicly said anything against the Soviet Union. Never. In fact, this is the first time I've ever done anything. Never. Because, especially, I didn't do this during the McCarthy period. And subsequently, because it's been the McCarthy period ever since, never changed. I will not feed the flames of anti-communism. Just a second. In the 1950s, there was a guy named Sidney Rogers. Any of you know his name?
Oh,
yes. No. Sid and I both lived in Berkeley. We were good friends. I used to babysit for him and so on and so on. And Sid was the had a radio program, which was the ILWU. Very, very good guy. And in 1951, I think it was, the state legislature put out a book on, it was the state, the legislative committee, the State Un-American Activity Committee, California State Un-American Activity Committee. They put out a book like this in 1951, or it may have been 1952, in which, among other things, they listed the leading communists in the state of California, leading members of the Communist Party. Number one, Sid Roger. Number two, Doug Dowd. Now, Sid and I would talk together a lot. We were good friends. But one thing we agreed on, we would never, ever say anything against the communists in public. Because we never said anything against them, obviously we must have been communists. Because we were lefties, okay? So we must have been communists. So there we were listed as the top two communists in the state of California. Neither one of us had anything to do with the party, except the party wouldn't have anything to do with us either. You know, we've been conditioned to think that whatever thing, we've been taught, not just conditioned, we've been taught to think you get what you deserve. That's part of our ideology. If you're rich, you earned it. Even though we know there are a lot of rich people, like Bush, for example, never did a day's work in his life. Even though the Rockefellers inherited, we know all about that, but we think, oh, well, if you're rich, somehow or another, you've got good genes at least. If you're poor, even if you yourself are poor, it's because what? Well, just didn't do the right things at the right time in the right place, or some goddamn fool thing like that. That most people never have a chance of ever getting out of anything like being poor, whether they're black or white, whether they're Chinese or Japanese or whatever. Most people never have a chance. It takes a lot of luck. It takes a lot of luck. Where luck means, where were you born? What color were you? When were you born? What was your family? Rich, poor, middle? You didn't work that out as you were squeezing yourself out of the womb. I mean, I've said this so many times. If I'd been born in Jackson, Mississippi, 1919 instead of San Francisco in 1919, to a black family, poor black family, do you think I'd be standing up here talking to you like this now? Do you think I'm some kind of a fucking genius? No matter where I'd been born, I could have come out and that's just bullshit. It's pure luck. What chances you have, and whether you take advantage of those chances. If you are lucky enough to be born the right color in the right place, the right time, and the right family, and so if you fuck up, okay, you fuck up. But mostly, people who are born well born, we say, are people who it isn't always shirt sleeves in three generations. They're in some sense or another taken care of, as Bush was taken care of. I mean, George W. Bush was a millionaire. He was this, he was that, and the other. He never did anything to get to do that. Everything was handed to him, whether by his family or by people who were using him with the oil companies and so on. Doesn't matter what it was. He was just handed everything. But George W. Bush, I'm convinced of this, thinks that he deserves, he earned what he got to be. Probably thinks he should be. Now, I don't want you to fall over your chairs now. He probably thinks he should be president of the United States, that he's a good president of the United States. I would bet my life that that's what he thinks. Well, there are all kinds of people who aren't presidents of anything, who are reasonably well off, or reasonably badly off, who nevertheless think that other people who are reasonably badly off deserve to be that way. But they even think, I'm sure this is true, that they deserve to be that way. We've been taught that.
We've been taught not to think in social analytical terms. We've been taught to think in personal terms. Hooray for individualism, but that isn't the way you run a society. A society has to be run as a society. So that's another thing we have to disenthrall ourselves about. I begin now with, what do we want? What do we, kinds of people like we are, what do we want? And that should also be followed by, what do we need? And that should be followed by, how do we get what we want and need? How do we get it? The politics, how do we do it? The program is easy. It's not as easy as pie, but it's easy. It requires us to change the way we live. Our way is going to be, the way we live is going to be changed anyway. It's changing. It's been changing ever since you've been alive. And it's been going from whatever it was to something worse, either for you or almost anybody else. Whether the worse is accompanied by having a car and a nice apartment, so that's okay. It's still worse. Because the quality of our life, the sensibility of our life, the stupidity of our life, all those things have gone in the wrong direction. To put it in Baron's terms, Paul Baron's terms, we've been taught to want what we don't need and not to want what we do. And he was just talking about commodities. I'm talking about everything. We've been really taught, we've relearned to want, to admire, to seek after things that are harmful to us or just plain dull, stupid, and to look with disfavor on the things that really would be good for our lives. We've been taught that. We've learned it. And although there's a nice kind of air of freedom in the latest younger generation, I think that they're terribly poisoned by that. You have to work. We, all of us, none of us can do more than work in one or two different organizations. But we have to see to it that those organizations connect with the organizations we can't work with directly so that we're working with them indirectly. There's no other way to win. There may be no way to win. I have my moments when I think there's no way to win. But I never have my moments when I think it's time to quit. When you do the kind of political work that's necessary and useful, it makes your life better. It makes your life better. It may not make the world's life better, but it makes your life better. It's a better way to live, better way of living. It must be understood that they have everything working for them except the things that are most important to us. And what we really have to do, when I say how are we going to work, what we really have to do is two things. One, understand the very strong probability that a very high percentage of people in this country are decent. When I say a high percentage, I mean maybe 25%. Consciously decent. You understand? I think a higher percentage of that unconsciously are decent, but they don't know about it. They don't know how to spell it out, so to speak. That's the first thing. They're out there. But they are also very hard to get to, very hard to talk to, very hard for any of us to talk to any of them. We've been taught that we don't have to be political. We have absorbed this whole notion from Adam Smith on that the free market will take care of everything that's important. And all we do is vote for people. We have no sense of class. And it's class that we're talking about here. Because the class that rules is the ruling class. And the ruling class is not all of it capitalist, but none of it would be there if it weren't for the being capitalist or connected positively with the capitalist class. Then you have other rulers who are other parts of the ruling class who are not part of the economy. They're evangelical Christians or they're gun people or they're political people of one sort or another. But it's a class. And most people in this country, when I say most, I mean 90% of the people in this country, have no sense that there is such a thing as a class structure. We talk of the middle class, but by the middle class we're talking about relationship to consumption, not production. When I talk about class, as Marx did, you're talking about the relationships and production relationships. Who owns and controls the means of life and who doesn't? And those who don't have to do whatever those who do want them to do on their terms. And those terms, as Marx said, those who control the means of production also control the intellectual life of the society. And he didn't just say ideas, he said ideas, but then he went on to say the intellectual life, which means the universities. It means the media. It means popular culture. It means non-popular culture.
It all has to fit in, or else it doesn't fit. And then it goes down the tubes, and so on. So we have this problem on our hands. First and foremost, convincing ourselves of just how much work we have to do, and then going out and trying to make contact, sympathetic, friendly contact with people who don't want to hear it. Because it's disturbing to realize how much work there is that needs to be done. But I'm not disturbed by thinking there aren't enough people out there, because if we had 10 million people, and we have more than 10 million people, we have at least 30 million people in my judgment, and I think that's an understatement, adults, who are really decent people in this country. But if we had just 10 million people, that would be the biggest movement in the world's history, in any capitalist country, that wanted to move toward basic needs. We're a unique country, you know, and it's something about... One of the things that's unique about this country is that people don't know anything about this country or about the rest of the world. It really is a kind of ignorance that is institutionalized about the rest of the world. We think that what we do here, this is not confined to us, but we think that what we do here is normal. That's the norm. In fact, we're really the nutballs of the whole world.
Lateral communication is needed, and which flattens the power instead of the hierarchical adoration or enthrallment of the person in charge.
Leader.
The hero, the leader, the ruler. And fame. We have to deal with fame now because of our media, celebrity. We can be easily caught up in an enthrallment. Even now, with what's been happening, you know, you have to work really hard to pull back and try to look clearly and not get fooled into thinking the media is telling you the whole story. They're not. And what you said about you're not looking towards equality for everybody, but a reduction of inequality. In other words, the idea of winning is a distraction too. What we need is to know how to relate with each other.
Listen, success, as I define success, means people are working for something. It doesn't mean you've gotten it. It means you're working for it. That's what success is.
Economist and author Dr. Doug Dowd, from his class series, The USA, Where We Are and Where We're Headed. To read more of Doug's work, visit on the web DougDowd.org, DougDowd.org. Thanks to Michael Slaughter for that recording, and many thanks to Chris McConkie, Bill Houston, Stefan Schweitzer, and the folks from the Binghamton IMC. You can download an MP3 of this and previous programs on the web at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all